are in Boston, Massachusetts at the Boston Park Plaza Hotel, which is the headquarters for CogSci 2011, the 33rd annual meeting of the Cognitive Science Conference. And you gentlemen are the first recipients of the Robert J. Glushko Awards for doctoral dissertations in outstanding cognitive science. But tell me who you are, what your discipline is, and what you wrote about to get an award.
I'm Eric Mandelbaum, and I'm from Yale University at the moment, Department of Philosophy. And my thesis was on, in the broadest sense, the structure and format of thought, but I cared about how beliefs were acquired and stored, and how to understand the ontological structure of what beliefs are, whether they're dispositions or have a certain type of propositional structure. And so in my thesis, I explored the idea that they're acquired through irrational means, and that they have a certain type of propositional structure, and that there's not a kind of single web of belief, but instead there's multiple beliefy fragments. So there's not kind of central rational mind, but a bunch of little minds interacting with one another.
And I'm Mike Frank. I'm at Stanford University in the psychology department. My thesis was on word learning. So I'm interested in how children learn the meanings of words. And the I guess the central argument of the thesis is basically that children learn words by thinking about what other people are trying to tell them. So by trying to work out what somebody's communicating in the moment, saying, well, are you trying to tell me about the dog, or are you trying to tell me about this stuffed animal or this this ball? You can actually then use that information about figuring out communication in the moment to help you learn words over the course of a childhood worth of experience.
Right. I'm Ed Vohl. I'm now in the psychology department at University of California in San Diego. And my thesis at MIT was on sampling and human cognition. The basic challenge was, how is it that people seem to approximate these very sophisticated statistical computations in their daily actions, whether it be planning motor movements or even learning words, like Mike's dissertation. And the basic premise that we started with is that, or the goal of the thesis was, that people approximate these statistical calculations not by considering all possible hypotheses as the statistical mathematics suggest you ought to, but by considering only a few hypotheses sampled with frequency proportional to the probability, that they only entertain a few possible worlds given their probability.
Now, you also did a paper that was attracted a great deal of attention last year.
I did, yes.
With the word voodoo in it.
Yes.
And basically what you would, correct me if I'm wrong here, you're basically saying that there are a number of papers out there that show that the general populace is more likely to believe a scientific study if it has a picture of brain in it somewhere. And you were saying that a lot of these things were actually not as accurate as you would have wished. Is that roughly
yeah,
right?
So the paper was on voodoo correlations, and the basic premise was that it's because of the difficulty of doing statistics with these large fMRI volumes, lots of people were making a mistake which greatly overestimated the correlation. So it would seem that they've found a portion of the brain which can predict with 90 or 80% of the variation in how much people feel love or something like this, whereas that actual number of how much of the variation across people was being predicted by the brain region was overestimated because of a very systematic mistake that was being made.
So the interesting point here, which you guys can comment on as well, is we're in Boston, so there's obviously lots of noise out there. cognitive science, and I've been talking to several people about this, it embraces a whole number of disciplines. And I've asked people whether underpinning it is neuroscience, whether it's just neuroscience with a few frills, to which I get very, responses, people saying, no, absolutely, the neuroscience is important, but there's a huge amount of other stuff going on there. You're talking about belief, you're talking about language.
I think it is in the end all done by the brain for the most part. I mean, maybe sometimes you can count on your hands, but in the end, most cognition is done, or all cognition is done by the brain. And so it will reduce to neuroscience at some point, but that doesn't mean that that neuroscience is the only useful way to talk about it. In physics, everything might reduce to quantum mechanics at some point, but we still talk about classical mechanics when we want to predict the movement of large objects. And similarly, when we talk about how people think or how humans interact, it will not be very useful or practical to try to make these predictions based on individual neurons interacting, but rather by these abstractions like beliefs and thoughts.
Belief, I mean, we've, the Science Network, if you look at the Science Network, you will find that we did three meetings called Beyond Belief about science, religion, language. This is your brain on economics, this is your brain on law. We looked at all these sorts of issues. What was your conclusion? I mean, how did you go about passing this very complex topic?
What I was interested in was this kind of, there's this Chomskyan insight for years and years and years. Chomsky would go around saying things like, people are so smart if you just look at how they use language. It's this kind of intrinsic creativity coming out in people. And then, this struck me as really interesting and overlooked. But then I interacted with people and I realized that, you know, all of us seem to have really crazy beliefs that are based on very little evidence. And so trying to reconcile how those two things would both be true, you get this idea that whatever our belief-forming structures are, they have to be reasonably separate from lots of kind of the other interesting higher cognitive functions we have. And so I started looking at some of the old literature on belief revision and a bunch of what were seemingly disparate and unrelated problems in the heuristics and biases tradition. And following a suggestion.
Kahneman, Tversky, mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
And so, for example, in the heuristics and biases tradition, you have the anchoring and adjustment heuristic, which looks fairly surprising in many ways. Why would this random anchor affect people's later judgments? And so I started toying around with the idea that what was happening was maybe people were forming an actual thought and that included the anchor as the answer to the question, and then using it as a belief. So I started just seeing how far I could push the assumption that anything that people actually think, they end up believing. And what it started looking like was that all of these reasonably mysterious problems made a lot more sense if I took on the premise that people actually just believe the things that they entertain. And so the majority of my work was looking at really disparate fields, some of which look like belief acquisition, and some of which just look like memory studies, some of which are just people's yay-saying and nay-saying behavior, and trying to see how this one assumption could spread some light on these disparate topics.
Right. So language, straight after that, obviously, is...
Absolutely. Well, I mean, a bunch of the work that I've done is really tries to connect what's underlying language, the kinds of beliefs or thoughts or concepts that you have, to the superficial form. So for example, things like number words and how they reflect the actual competence and the kinds of ideas we have about numbers.
Talk to me about your sense of the architecture of mind, if you like. What interests me here is, I mean, you were in Nancy Kamish's lab for
correct, yes.
And Nancy has a very strong view about the mind having specific areas devoted to doing certain things. The whole F-psych tradition of John Tooby and Levi Cosmides talks about a massively massively modular mind with areas devoted to doing and indeed in the genome.
It seems that. From
so do you have the same view of the mind, or do you think it's more flexible than that? I mean,
it seems that there are some dedicated portions of the brain for specific functions. However, I guess the degree of what you mean by modularity kind of depends on the degree to which I will agree with you, which is that if you suggest that modules can only take a specific kind of input and only make judgments based on a very local set of information. That seems to be wrong in the sense that for every kind of inference we make, whether it be trying to figure out whether the person walking down the street is a cop or a criminal, we bring to bear on that lots of knowledge, like how they walk, what time of day it is, what they're carrying. So for all of these judgments, we bring to bear lots of little pieces to make the final judgment. And so it seems that all these modules and all these sources of information interact very richly, and to suggest, and this is what Mike's work also.
I was going to say that. I mean, one of the speakers, obviously, at this meeting is Noam Chomsky, and to some extent, the F-psych thing leans heavily on Chomsky's original notion of there being a language, or as Steve Pinker would put it, a language instinct, right? Language module. This is your area.
It's certainly clear that there are aspects of the human mind that are prepared for and motivate human children to learn language, and that doesn't happen in other species. But the one key part of that is the learning process, is the process of acquisition that kids go through. And in the case of word learning, I think this is really a canonical case where modularity just doesn't play a big role in the sense that word learning is one of these really core areas in cognitive science where just about everything comes into play. So you get perceptual information about what's salient in a perceptual scene or in a physical context, but you also have social information about what the other person is thinking, what the other person is trying to tell you. You have conceptual information about the structure of the world or the possible structure of a concept that you're trying to learn, and you also have the structure of the language that's being used. So all of those things are really coming together in word learning to make inferences that go beyond any one of the information sources. So word learning especially, and more broadly a lot of aspects of early language acquisition, rely on all of this external contextual information, social information. So it's not clear, for the rules of word order like syntax, what Chomsky described, there may be some aspects of encapsulation or modularity, but for language learning more broadly, it's not clear that view is necessarily correct.
So, I agree with a good amount of what Mike said, but I'm a bit more positive about the aspects or the prospects for modularity than I think Ed was. I think it's an open question how modular things are. You look at the original Fedorian proposal, it's a starting point. I think it would be very surprising if everything Fodor originally wrote was correct, but I would also be surprised if there's not some degree of truth to encapsulation. And I, at least in my work, I assume a certain amount of modularity, and then whether the encapsulation works over time or is just at a given time for information, I think those are open questions. Instead, I thought the kind of more interesting issue that's not raised very often is, at least in traditional modularity, there's this idea of central cognition as this really rational single place. And a lot of the work from Tooby and Cosmides, and certainly from Fodor, was looking at these modules and seeing how far we can push them in. But really, there was this either assumption of a deep rational center or no center at all. I think both of those options are reasonably unacceptable. Although I think the modularity question's a bit more open, I worry a bit about what the contrast class is to it.
Yeah. It's interesting because, I hadn't talked to you before we did this. I didn't even know what your dissertations were about, but you see how interesting the conversation has weaved through this field and reveals the sort of richness of cognitive science. How did you elect to go into these areas? What was the driving force for your going into this discipline?
I think for me, I was always interested in language, and that started out as an interest in novels and literature and literary theory, and from there I started thinking about philosophical questions about how language even worked at all, how it was possible to have a conversation. Mm-hmm. And from there, it's a short step to getting sucked into the lab by a couple of great mentors who said, these philosophical questions, you could actually test those with kids. So,
who were the mentors?
The first person who did that for me was Lera Boroditsky, who is known for her work on language and thought, but really was just totally inspiring in her way of thinking about philosophical questions and saying, those are actually empirical questions and can be tested with really clever methods just in the lab in simple, easy ways.
Yeah, I had a conversation with her last year on at COGSA.
I had a similar experience wherein I started working in a lab, and it just seemed to be a constant, nonstop flow of interesting questions and interesting pursuits, and it still hasn't ended. And so that was the first job where I wasn't bored after about 3 months, because there was constantly a new question, and curiosity was never sated.
Where was this?
This was in San Diego, where I was an undergraduate with Hal Pashler and Don McLeod.
Right.
And so that's continued throughout, and still curious.
I was originally influenced from Fodor. I was a student at Rutgers, and when I was young, I took some grad classes with him, and was very, at the time, interested in what rational control was, how it seemed like I could, in some instances, have this great wealth of rational control over my behavior, and then these other instances, thoughts just seemed to be racing together, and there was very little control we seemed to have over our behavior. And so it was a really hard question to get my head around, and instead started looking at these kind of equally broad but more manageable questions of the general architectural setup, what it would mean to even have rational control over thoughts, what it would mean for our thoughts to be reason responsive. And so that's what got me down the track.
So do you, I mean, as you talk amongst yourselves, I'm thinking back to Jerry Fodor's books and so on, and obviously there's they're completely at odds with, say, a neurophilosophical perspective.
Sometimes.
But well written and very witty. How do you navigate through all this difficult conceptual space? I mean, how do you find yourself making decisions and coming up with positions for yourself?
I guess my attitude is very pragmatic about these kinds of questions. So when you go into the lab and you start actually spending some time with children who are trying to learn the meanings of words, and you immerse yourself in that data, you get a picture that feels intuitively at odds with some views or intuitively more congruent with others. But when you're sort of in there in the trenches working, you really try to construct a picture that's close to the data, and then gradually you kind of surface and look around and look at the theoretical space. So there, the day-to-day of doing an experiment and of trying to figure out a particular question or issue, I think is less affected by whether the mind is massively modular than you might immediately expect. So often, when we get together at these kinds of conferences, that we start to think about these bigger theoretical issues and how the findings from different areas come together. But many of the answers that we get on the way there are relevant regardless of your theoretical tradition. I think that's the strength of the empirical work.
Yeah. Did you all expect to? How did you get onto a science track at all when you were? I mean, was there some stimulus, a teacher, a book, parents?
It was a job. I started working in a lab as a programmer. And that was, started off as a job, and then I got curious to the point where I wanted to do that, dedicate the rest of my life to doing that.
Okay.
For me, it was Gödel, Escher, Bach, the Douglas Hofstadter book. I read that. I was commuting out to it, this dreary publishing job from New York City to New Jersey, and it was like a 2.5-hour commuter rail ride every day. So I worked my way through this book in about half a summer, and by the end of it, I was pretty convinced that I wanted to do cognitive science.
But for me, I think it was modularity of mind. When I first read it, it seemed like such an interesting way of looking at this huge swath of literature and trying to make sense of it in a kind of high-level sense. I disagree with most of it, but I appreciate the methodology very much. There's Language of Thought, another book I very much disagree with, has this beautiful introduction where it talks about this field of speculative psychology that no longer exists. And we are kind of reviving it by caring about these theoretical issues, and that was what I wanted to be a part of.
So, one of the questions I like to ask people about is the relevance of science to society. When he came into office, President Obama talked about restoring science to its rightful place. Do you have any sense of what the rightful place of science is in society?
Well, I think there are lots of gains from science. However, it's very hard to predict them. And so at some point, science becomes engineering, and engineering is very, very useful. I think science is also useful in the sense that it answers questions that we're curious about. Everybody wants some of these, especially for cognitive science and philosophy, everybody wants to know these intuitive questions, like what is it, why do we think the way that we think, and so forth. And at some point, some of these things become practical and turn into engineering, and then it has very real economic social ramifications, and so it has two goals.
Yeah. Mike, anyway?
I think many people in cognitive science are realizing the decreasing distance between the kinds of work that we do and real-world applications. So again, thinking about my own work, one of the clear applications of studying social word learning is for the treatment and diagnosis of autism. So that's one place where the kind of work that I do makes contact with the world. But all over this conference, you'll see folks who are doing work that is not applied, but is much closer to applications. In part, that's because of changes in funding emphases and so forth. But in part, that's because cognitive science as a discipline is maturing a little bit, and we really are starting to see places where we know enough to make a difference. So I think that that's quite exciting.
And I know that what I'm currently thinking about, the implicit bias literature, I was interested in it because I thought it would tell me something about the structure of thought. But the more you think about it, it's quite close to issues that do matter in people's day-to-day lives. When you hear about police shooting someone who was innocent, who they thought was innocent, and they say that they have no explicit bias, and you start wondering how were they so trigger happy and what was happening there. I think to understand that people who do these seemingly heinous crimes are perhaps not so heinous, and to try to combat the prejudices that are there, that seems like a reasonably important job. I think we're incredibly far away from doing anything successful there. I also wonder how much of Obama's quote was actually meant to say that the government's going to stay out of science, as opposed to science going to help government now. Mm.
Do you think about the historical context very much? One of the things that I've discovered is in talking to students, grad students, and so on, is that they, because they have to do this job and get this degree and get drilled in and so on and so forth, they don't spend much time on context. So they download the PDF and from Nature, but they don't read the rest of the book and so on and so forth. And one of my great passions is history and philosophy of science. So I often like to ask people, if you think about these issues outside your immediate area, and if I gave you a time travel token and said you could bring to your dinner table anybody and have a conversation with them, is there anybody you would like to have a chat with and ask questions from, any time, any period?
I'd definitely go with William James.
Yeah, William James.
I think that would be a tremendous fun to see somebody who's thinking so broadly about so many human issues, but really in a very psychological way. For me, William James is really this point in philosophy and psychology where a lot of the pragmatic views that I am excited by really kind of came together and gave birth to American pragmatism in philosophy and also to the tradition of Anglo-American psychology that grew into cognitive science in a lot of ways. So I love his work and would love to sit down and hear what he'd think of some of the stuff that's going on now.
Either of you?
Probably Alan Turing. It seemed like he was constantly full of good ideas, cut short. So probably there's even more. So if you get him here now, I can steal some of them.
Since Turing's taken, I think I'd go with Hume. David Hume had...
These are great choices.
Just really... Well, I'm teaching a history of philosophy of science class right now, so I'm very up to date on the people I really like to talk to. But Hume had this incredibly contemporary view of the mind where I think cognitive science is just very frequently rediscovering insights in Hume.
There is, in fact, a book out by Patricia Churchland at the moment called Brain Trust, in which she looks at the Hume notion, which is often misunderstood of you can't get an ought from an is, and and the whole notion of morality. Do you think about these issues? Moral, lots of books out at the moment on the neural basis of morality.
I mean, I found it very interesting trying to do a synthesis of this as a teacher of intro developmental psych, trying to really revisit the sea change that's happened in thinking about morality over the past 10, 15 years. If you go to Freud, if you go to Piaget, you've got this sense of kind of the little internal demon. But the empirical results we've started to see over this period of time have been pointing towards much more controlled, reasoned, and mature moral sense within kids. It's been very, very interesting to see how that narrative has changed, from something like Kohlberg, where everybody is sort of being reined in by laws to these judgmental toddlers and judgmental infants who are actually thinking about other people's place in their social group and how they help or hurt and so forth. So I think it's really an exciting moment for morality. We're just seeing how our view is flip-flopping from the old Freudian view to something new and exciting.
I'm not as up to date on these things, but I suppose I'm more influenced by the economic traditions that have been emerging for forging morality, which is that
Adam Smith's,
but also just the basic notion that notions of morality are very much based on sort of the social context, that we have our morality's forged by what other people expect of us, how they expect us to behave, not so much anything intrinsic or in the Platonic realm. It's basically about maximizing social interaction in a way and trying to get people to cooperate with you and you cooperate with them, rather than some Platonic ideal.
So a constraint satisfaction sort of
constraint satisfaction, which would account for why some countries have moral codes which would be appalling to us, but in that country it's normal to, and it would be unacceptable to act any other way.
I try to keep up with a decent amount of it, but I think some of what Mike said I agree with. It's interesting to see how complex the processing is for people's moral judgments, and at the same time, it's reasonably bizarre to see, on the one hand, you know, something that looks like it could just be purely affect has more than just affect there, but then moral judgments are playing this really wide role in many cognitive spaces that they really shouldn't have any role in. And so it's interesting to see that, on the one hand, moral judgments are a bit more complex than you might have thought, just kind of backhanded if you just had this effective view. And yet we can't really rein them in. They seem to bleed into all of these other places that if we were really kind of rational and designing a mind from basic principles, we would not have that.
All right, so the Glasgow Prize awardees. I mean, what do you, nice that you got the award, congratulations. First one. What are you optimistic about?
Well, for me, I'm really optimistic in cognitive science about the birth of new methods, especially computational methods, and the ways that they can really help us constrain our theories and put together more quantitative, more formal theories. So that's a lot of the work that I find most exciting here and in general, is seeing formal methods get applied to rich empirical data, really bringing in larger sets of information from the world. Clearly that's happening because of web-based data collection, these huge social network data sets, but also from rich social interaction data from video and sensor-based data sets, all of these things coming together and being synthesized using techniques from machine learning and computer science. So the combination of big data and also more formal, more computational models, I think that's really a stunning combination. It's going to be very exciting to watch.
I agree with that completely. I also think that I'm excited to see that engineering is turning to using human cognition. So there's crowdsourcing is a thing that's very widely used by companies now. You turn to the human mind and to outsource little people who can make little judgments that you can't otherwise get a computer to make. And by turning to the human mind as an engineering tool, it both increases the degree to which we formalize the study of it using the tools that Mike described, but also starts bringing to bear more of the results that we have from cognitive science to industry and to the applications in the economy.
I'm not used to being optimistic, but I'll take a stab. I think that a lot of the work in moral psychology right now is really advanced from where a lot of fields of cognitive science was 20 years ago. So, you know, we have debates about nativism or empiricism about certain concepts. But instead, if we actually kind of focus on the nitty-gritty and what the computational roles of the concept are, you look that there's actually a lot of good work that's happening right now, and a big boom in and getting very clear on how these concepts work. In a kind of broader sense, it's nice that during this economic collapse, there still are kind of cognitive science centers. You know, when I was originally going to graduate school, I thought, oh, I'm such an idiot. There's never going to be a cognitive science department. And it's not that there are cognitive science departments everywhere now, but it's reasonably hopeful that they haven't been closed down. So maybe for the next generation, there'll actually be cognitive science departments where you can get primary appointments all over. That's one reason to be hopeful.
Well, congratulations, gentlemen. It's been great talking to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.